Welcome to Clearly Quaker, an ongoing series of podcasts by Salem Quarterly Meeting, part of the Religious Society of Friends. Salem Quarterly Meeting is an association of seven Southern New Jersey Quaker meetings within Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. The following podcast is a lecture by Chris Densmore, curator of Friends Historical Library at Swarthmore College in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania. Chris has an abiding scholarly and personal interest in historic Quaker journals and shared his knowledge with friends gathered for this series of lectures. This first lecture, given at Mullica Hill Friends Meeting House in Mullica Hill, New Jersey, is a general introduction to historic Quaker journals.
There are a couple of reasons this project on Quaker journals came about, and one of which is that every once in a while, like every month or so, some meeting calls up and says, "We have these old Quaker books, and we don't know what to do with them." And I say, "I have lots of old Quaker books, and I would love to have people come here and use them." But because sometimes, this book was published in 1898 or 1820 or 1760, and they feel they can no longer take care of it. I said, "Well, if I've got two good copies on my shelf that I'm protecting, I really don't need three or four or five or 10. But there's all kinds of interesting stuff in there, and if you can get two or three people to read through those old books, even if they fall apart, it's better than just have them sitting in some closet somewhere." There's a whole host of very good Quaker literature out there. And one of the sort of typical Quaker forms is the journal. The greatest first example is George Fox's journal. He's not just writing the Journal of his times, he's writing about his experiences with the Lord and his life. There's a point to it. It's literally a life lived in the light. And if you go to John Woolman's journal, it's the same thing. He's not just writing a journal, he's writing this to share with people because it has certain understandings and moral objectives. And so there's a great literature like this. And it's very interesting because New Jersey in the middle of the 18th century, the 1700s, there must have been something in the water around this area, some strange mist that came in the night and grabbed people by the head, because we had John Woolman up here at Mount Holly, and he's contemporary of John Hunt, whose journal I'm going to talk about this afternoon, who lived near Morristown, Joshua Evans, who is a truly fantastic journal. And one of the stories about John Evans, he became very concerned, he's very concerned about plainness, and the plainness comes very much out of the way of trying to avoid the vanities of the world, but also sort of a social question is, what happens when we enjoy things like sugar that's produced by slave labor? Aren't we in fact enabling slavery to go on? If we can get rid of people using sugar and show, you could sell us free sugar. I'm produced by slave labor, and then there's a market for it. It's actually a very interesting economic issue. So it's both a moral issue and an economic issue. And you'll see this through a lot of the Quaker anti-slavery. Elias Hicks, when he writes against slavery in the early 1800s, it's the same thing. You open this thing, you sort of expect that it's going to be this moral crusade about, the terrible things that are going on. But in fact, is sort of a argument for the tainted fruit of the tainted tree, that how can we be using sugar? Because sugar is produced by slaves. Why are they slaves? Well, in theory, they or their ancestors were taken captive in wars in Africa. Quakers aren't supposed to be benefiting from war, so neither we should be able to benefit from slavery. There's another argument in here about to maintain institution of slavery over time means you have to be willing to stand up with guns and knives and put down the rebellions that come up, and that's hardly a sort of a Quakerish point of view. So one of the interesting stories about Joshua Evans is that he decides to wear a white hat or an undyed hat. John Woolman does the same thing, and so he writes his journal. You know, he's so sort of concerned with this, and it's like, I'm going to be the laughingstock, you know. How can I do that? Particularly because he is a friend traveling to the ministry, that people are going to say, this person represents the Society of Friends, and he's wearing this funny hat and these funny clothes. And finally, he does decide to that's what's required of him. The meeting kind of probably is looking around and, you know, hey, wait a minute, we got John Woolman, we got these crazy people around here. You know, they don't look totally reputable. Then Joshua Evans gets the idea of, why am I shaving? You know, naturally men grow beards. It's like, why are we cutting off this thing that we have naturally? Isn't that just the vanity? So he decides to grow a beard. And at this point, no Anglo-American in this country was wearing a beard. That would be considered very, very strange. Maybe some of the Germans were, but it was just odd. It was something people hadn't thought of. And so in this case, the meeting actually gets together and says, what are we going to do about Joshua Evans? And because he's out there representing us, you know, they're going to think Quakers are crazy. This is one of the reasons you acknowledge ministers, so you could say, oh, they're an acknowledged minister over there, so when they're talking, we can listen to them, and that person over there is just nuts. And you know, he comes to the meeting, but we, you know, what are we going to do with him? And Evans explains why he wants to do this, and the meeting basically says, yeah, we get where you're coming from, and we can't see any reason to say no to your beard, but we're, you know, we haven't reached that point yet. And Quakers are very concerned about uniformity at this time. You know, what happens if you've got some people doing, identifying, you know, working with testimonies one way and working with testimonies the other way? And so they say, okay, Joshua, you can go. His journal should be better known. There's a sort of a shortened version in an obscure Quaker publication called Friends Miscellany, but he's just a great person. But anyway, you have John Woolman, Joshua Evans, John Hunt, we're going to in a few minutes. They're all contemporaries, maybe all born within about a 25-year spread. And some of them, I think all of them are related to each other in some fashion, the way some Quaker families go. You also have some very early Quaker anti-slavery writing from this part in New Jersey. What's his name? David Cooper, I think, is writing things, and some other characters. It's sort of like, in the history of the world, everybody had thought, or at least the world as far as any Anglo-Americans knew it, that slavery might be deplorable, it might be sad, but this was a system. You know, the Egyptians had it, the Greeks had it, the Romans had it, even the Hebrews, with their, even though they got the Jubilee, you know, they had it, and everybody has it. And so while you may deplore it, it seems like this is not going to go away. This is just the way the world works, which is said, can be said for a lot of social evils at this point. You know, we're never going to get rid of poverty, so why should we put ourselves out? We'll never get rid of demon rum. But that was another one. So he got to So Joshua Evans, sort of lose my train of thought for a minute because there's so many wonderful things here. Anyways, a lot of that testimony is coming out of New Jersey and then is being picked up by people like Anthony Benezé in Philadelphia and then goes overseas and influences the British. If you want to find the origins of the British anti-slavery crusade, they're right here. They're in New Jersey and Philadelphia. That's who they were reading. That's who Thomas Clarkson was reading. And he says so explicitly. He doesn't say Quakers are the only thing that was it, but that certainly was one of the trajectories. John Woolman, one of the founders of the Methodist Church, John Wesley, writes a pamphlet about slavery, and it actually is sort of a paraphrase of one of Benezé's pamphlets. Not to work at that time, because people had different attitudes about plagiarism at that time. He's got good ideas, so let's write them down. Anyway, one of the things that happened is a fair number of people kept journals. And usually, a lot of the Quaker journals are friends traveling to ministry. You know, I went to so-and-so meeting, then I went to so-and-so meeting, then I went to so-and-so meeting, and friends were very tender, and these ones fell asleep, and oh my goodness, am I really where I'm supposed to be, sort of thing. So that's one kind. You know, John Woolman's journal, if you look for that, what was John Woolman's family life like? You know, who knows? You know, what did he do for a living? You get a little bit of that, but a lot of things that you might expect to find in a journal aren't there, because that's not what it's about. I think that some people just, they're Quakers, but they're keeping a journal, and it's mostly about, I plowed the field, I did this, I did that, and went to meeting on first day, and then I plowed the field some more, and then went to meeting on fourth day. But what John Hunt does is he's born in 1740, and when he's 30 years old, in 1770, he begins keeping a journal. He's living in Colestown, just a few miles south of Morristown. He's a member of that meeting for his entire life through various name changes. That one time was Chester Meeting, now it's Morristown. Morristown meeting, and he starts by quoting William Penn about what's a good idea to sort of keep a journal because it's sort of a mental discipline. You know, what have you done with your life? Even if you're not out having visions or walking up the top of Pendle Hill, it's sort of like, you know, I can look back in my journal and say I was doing productive things, or maybe I should be a little more attentive to these kinds of things. Hunt's remarkable because he keeps both. He is a very active friend. He's constantly going from one meeting to another, traveling, visiting in the normal course of quarterly meetings, and at that time, monthly meetings. Had several local meetings, so he's traveling back and forth, and he's going to Philadelphia. And one of the things we tend to forget here in the lower Delaware Valley is how much we're sort of a social social unit, that the Delaware River really didn't make much difference to anybody. Hunt is constantly going to yearly meeting or other meetings in Philadelphia. Well, what is he going to do? You know, he gets on his wagon, he drives down to Philadelphia, he drives across from Philadelphia, gets on the ferry, and there he is. It's actually somewhat faster if he just did it all on wagon. So you see people in the Quaker records, people transfer their membership from Morristown to Byberry to Abington to Salem. You know, they're just all traveling around this area, and the sort of the names appear. It's only in the modern era we sort of think these boundaries. We make more significance of them than perhaps they should get. So he keeps a journal, and it's got all kinds of things in there. And one of the interesting things about working at Friends Library is people look at documents and they see very different things because they come to it different ideas and say, oh my goodness, this is telling me about women, gender. Well, I'm old enough to remember when women didn't have a history, you know, like women, history? No, history is done by Andrew Jackson and George Washington and that kind of thing. And then people sort of, there was a famous diary, Hannah Ballard's diary, and it had been published in the 19th century, in a woman in rural Maine. And here's this account of so-and-so coming to town and some festivities on the green. And then in the 20th century, not all that long ago, some woman historian looks at that and says, my goodness, she's a midwife. And she has recorded every single midwifery case that she's had. And she's not just a midwife on occasion, this person's being called out several times a week. So all of a sudden you've got this great social history about, you know, women and children and the relationship between midwives who are almost exclusively in this time and place female and doctors, almost exclusively male at this point. It finds out some interesting things like doctors often didn't deal with routine births, go see the midwife. And midwives would go to the doctors if, hey, we got a problem with this one, you know, and you've got the kinds of skills we need for this case, but it just became this whole case. One of the readings I had there is not actually Hunt, but somebody coming over this area much earlier, much later in the 1890s, I believe, and writes a long account of his travels in the Friend, the Quaker publication from Philadelphia. And he's not only looking out for the Edgepillic. Can anybody give me a better pronunciation than that? The Edgepillic, the Brotherton Reservation. The Lenape were still, well, actually some of them still live here, but one of the things both Joshua Evans and John Hunt record is going to visit with the Delaware Indians in the 1770s and 1780s and earlier on. And some of these folks will later move up to upstate New York and associate with be the guests of the Oneida Indians of the Iroquois Confederacy. And then most of them will move out to Wisconsin, where there is the Brotherton Stockbridge Indian Reservation. And some of these are descendants of the Indians who lived right here. So you get someone like Joshua Evans, who's visiting these people in the 1770s, worried about destitution, and he's visiting them again in the 1790s in upstate New York and looking at their conditions. And this will go on for many, many years. And it's not, there's going to be a conference on Quakers and Native Americans on the second weekend in November, which you can find about. You can probably just Google it or get in touch with me. It's free. It's in Philadelphia. There'll be all kinds of good people, including Native Americans and some people that are from the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting Indian Committee. A lot of things in this period circulated in manuscript. And so, you know, you're keeping a journal, but you're not necessarily thinking you're going to run down to the offices of your local publisher and say, publish my journal. Hunt's journal floated around in manuscript for, it was really only about 15 years. So I guess that's not bad. At one point in his journal, he's got this tantalizing reference to see so-and-so's vision on slavery. I look for it and I can't find it. It's probably one of those things that somebody had a vision, and Quakers are always a little sort of hesitant about visions because you can be just crazy, or this can be some, you know, this is really some insight that you've gotten, and you know, how do you tell the difference? You know, John Woolman has visions, but unlike other people, some other people would have a vision and say, oh yeah, God came down and talked to me and he sat over there and I did this and he told me to do that. John Woolman is having visions or dreams and he writes them down because he thinks they may be significant. You know, he's not claiming authority because I'm the one who had a vision. He's not pointing people to what they do. But somewhere out there floating around is this vision about slavery, probably by another one of those crazy New Jersey Quakers. And I hope I'll find it sometime. Anyway, the manuscript comes down to us, and we had the part that went from 1770 to 1800. And then we had a part that was published about 5% of the journal. Very heavily edited, was published in Friends Miscellany. So we had that text. And then about, five, maybe more years ago, somebody else in the family came up with the last third, from 1812 to Hunt's death in 1824, including Asa Stackhouse, that possibly some of you know. Local fellow, Stackhouses, New Jersey. And we're still actually missing a chunk in the middle of the original manuscript. We can kind of fill it in from the printed version, which is much shorter, but you know, look in your attics, folks, and see what you and see what you've got there. We're also doing this with the funding from a direct descendant of John Hunt, David and Joyce Hunt from Colorado Springs. And we're having students transcribe these things. Most people look at old handwriting and go, oh, I can never read that. But in fact, if you can even read longhand anymore, which I guess we're no longer going to have people do, most people can kind of figure it out after looking at the script for an hour or so. You know, in 5 hours, they're pretty good. And a couple weeks, and they're pretty proficient. So we could use them. So it's been a lot of fun. It's been a kind of way to do things. We're planning to publish the Hunt journals. The problem of it is that just the main text alone is 1,000 single-spaced pages. So that's a long way of doing things. We've talked interlined books, sort of preliminary, and hope to be doing it. It's the sort of thing probably not a lot of people are going to rush out and buy 5-6 volumes of Hunt's works, but we can subsidize printing of, you know, a certain number of copies to make sure they're at the proper historical societies and state libraries, that sort of thing. So what has it got into it? Hunt, like a lot of other Quakers at the time, lives in a Quaker world. You know, the people he has business dealings, you know, they're all Lippincotts and such. Where he's going to meeting one place and another place. He reads a lot and writes down things, but it's either Quaker works or works of people that friends tended to read. There are people like William Law, who was actually an Anglican minister in England, but Quakers loved his writings. And so even though he was a priest, they kept in publication. Thomas A. Kempis. For many, many years, the only editions of that in English were the Quaker edition, translated by John Payne. I'm talking to the late 19th century, and a version translated by a Methodist. And so here's a book that's sort of nominally a Catholic work, a medieval German mystic, but it's being distributed to Quakers by Quaker printers, through Quaker bookstores, and all that sort of thing. So that's kind of very interesting. One of the things I was going to mention about the visit to Edgefield, like, you know, coming out there, is one of the things that comes out of there, he's very interested, the person who comes is very interested in the flora and fauna. And he talks about cranberries and how they're growing and plant names, Latin plant names, and the whole kind of thing. And that's one of the things we work with at Friends Libraries, you know, what's a Quaker book, is the fact that the guy's a Quaker and writing a book about astronomy or geology or botany, does that make it something we want for Friends Historical Library? And at one point, a fair number of the working botanists in the world were Quakers. You know, the Bartrams, the Fothergills, the Marshalls, even out in Chester County, the sort of local folks like the Darlingtons, guys, and they're writing very complicated works too. I tracked down one of these people from a family in Philadelphia, and she wrote a book on insects for children. So insects for children, we're going to learn about the jolly spider and how it's actually our friend because it eats jolly flies. And matter of fact, it starts out with spider taxonomy and goes into, you know, legs and how they're attached and the nature of the beast for 20, 30 pages. I can just see people delighted to get this for Christmas and open it up and say, oh, I can read about spider thoraxes and spiracles and stuff. But you see that account of coming over here to New Jersey, that part of there's a big chunk of the Quaker experience that was very interested in things like botany in a very, very serious way. You know, you couldn't go horse racing, you couldn't go gambling, you couldn't go drinking. So let's go look at the plants in the backyard and make discoveries. And as a matter of fact, you could at that time, because there's a lot of just observational science. Jonathan Edwards, the great colonial American preacher, his first published work when he was 12 years old was a description of how a spider makes its nest. And it was printed in the Proceedings of the Royal Academy of Sciences in England. Because he was just smart enough to be able to sit down on his keister, as my father would say, and observe and you know, say exactly what was going on. There are things in the journal about wars. You know, the war from a Quaker perspective at this time is you're going to get a whole lot of people coming to your door and said, have you paid your taxes yet? I said, no, that's for war. I'm not going to pay my taxes. And then the guy comes into your house and says, well, you know, we've got a fine against you of 5 shillings, 4 pence, and you're not going to give me the money. No, I'm not going to give you the money. So I'll just go find something. Oh, that pair of candlesticks over there, that's very nice. I think that'll do nice. And so they walk out the door with a pair of candlesticks that cost them £2. And you know, Quakers got to just sort of sit there and go, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then the meeting will have a book of sufferings, and so they'll record everything in great detail and say, on such and such a date, such and such a person, enforcing such and such a law, you know, for a fine of whatever, took enumerate items, and there you go. Actually, I was looking at some of those sufferings records, and it was sort of interesting because in some places, if you were a Quaker and were caught not paying your fines, you know, the authorities came down on you heavy and fast. It's like, okay, you know, if it's worth £2, we'll take it for a 10 shilling fee. And then you saw some meetings where it looked either like the local authorities ignored them, or they walked into somebody's room and said, you got a fine for, you know, 10 shillings, 4 pence. And let's see what you got. How about that used coverlet over there? It's worth maybe a shilling. And they walk off. You know, they're just, it's like, you know, you live in a community and your neighbors are all there. You know, do you really want to get your neighbors all angry at you, even if they're Quakers? That's one of the reasons that Quakers eventually got religious toleration. It was people were just tired of having your neighbors dragged off to the prison every once in a while. It's just, it's too much work. Let's forget about it. So there are things about war, and I don't think it's in the Hunt Journal, but there's an issue with the Camden Meeting House, where somebody actually gives the key to the American forces, who then occupy the meeting house, and it's like, you shouldn't have given it to him, you know. Well, I didn't give it to him. They would knock down the door and say, no, you don't understand. You should not have given it to him. Doing things like leaving the money for your fines on the mantle was not an approved idea. Quakers were very strict about this during the Revolution. This is also the period when Quakers are finally coming to grips with slavery. You know, we kind of today have this idea, there's slavery and there's not slavery. You know, just not slavery, and slavery, of course, is just a totally bad thing. But in fact, it gets awfully complicated and gets awfully difficult if you have a slave system. You know, how do you pull yourself away from it? One of the things in New York, they had a system of gradual emancipation. In the late 1790s, they wanted to push toward full emancipation. But one of the things that skewered it is, what's going to happen to the small children, the ill, the lame, the elderly? Now it's their master's got to deal with that. You know, if we give everybody their freedom, you know, they're going to come over to the town offices, knock on the door and say, hi, I don't have any place to stay, I don't have any place to eat. And unlike some certain conservatives that think there was a time in which governments ignored the welfare of their people, you know, it was, you know, townships were responsible for this sort of thing. So is it this kind of situation, or do we free people, are they citizens, do they vote? You know, this is kind of sometimes a separate issue. You can have people that are very pure in heart, like Lucretia Mott, that gets the whole bit, but other times it took a lot of time. And so when these Quakers start, they're going against the idea that slavery just exists, it exists at all times. And maybe you as an individual can say no to slavery, or you can make sure the slaves are treated better or worse or whatever, but it's not going to go away. I tell people sometimes, you know, if you like the end of chattel slavery in the Anglo-American world, thank a Quaker. If you like women voting, thank a Quaker. If you're interested in the whole list of things where Quakers are very involved. But then you come to the peace testimony, and like, it's, you know, that's the equivalent today. If somebody says, we want to totally abolish war, which I hope we all do, but other people just look at you and say, you know, that doesn't happen. That's something that happens after Jesus Christ comes down to run the world. And so it's unthinkable. But at one time, women speaking in public was unthinkable, except for Quakers. And incidentally, if you go through John Hunt's journal, he's very careful to say who appeared in meeting. By appeared, he means who spoke. And for long periods of time, it's more likely to be a woman than a man. So this form of equality within the Society of Friends was quite true. For the longer travels in the ministry, it was often guys that did it, like, hi, I'm going away for the next 2 years. I'm going to visit every single meeting in North America, and then Ireland, and then Britain, and maybe Holland, and I'll keep a light on for me. But occasionally, that was women that did it. You know, women with small children at home and say, oh, husband, you know, take care of them, take care of our little joys. You know, I'll see you in 2 or 3 years. And the neighborhood, you know, presumably local Quakers kind of pitched in to make sure that they weren't starving to death and dying in the fields, sort of thing. But, it, you know, both genders did it. One of the difficult things about telling the story of slavery, because slavery is sort of this unresolved issue that's been in American history for all this time. You know, it's still unresolved. Not slavery itself, but, you know, what Black Lives Matter. No, all lives matter. It can really touch on people in a very basic way. And so for a long time, there was this sort of myth of the noble Quaker abolitionist, the John Woolman. And then somebody says, wait a minute, John Woolman's trying to convince his fellow Quakers to get rid of slaves. They had slaves. And this is a lot of what John Hunt is doing. He's traveling around with other people to talk to people. The yearly meeting has been advising people about being involved with the slave trade. I mean, this is policy, back in the 1690s. And in 1753 and 1754, the yearly meeting puts out statements that basically say, slavery is against the will of God. No Quakers should involve themselves with slavery in any form. You should free people. You should make sure that they have resources to deal with life as a free person. And everybody said, yeah, that's great. Yearly meeting consensus, all that sort of thing. And then people like John Woolman would get on his horse and visit every Quaker within a certain quarter. And people would sit down and say, I know slavery is wrong. And I guess I'll free them, but maybe after the next harvest or, wait a minute, he's taking care of, my mother had a stroke and she's upstairs and she can't move. And if we let Sally go, who's going to take care of mother? Just all these kinds of reasons. And it's not until 1775 and 1776 that the Society of Friends as a whole says, nope, now we're going to tell you again and labor with you a little bit more. And if you do not free this enslaved people, you are going to be disowned. And to the credit of the Society of Friends, by about 1780, slavery does not exist among Quakers from Nova Scotia to South Carolina and Georgia. No other denomination does this. You get a few little sectarian groups off the Methodists and Baptists that come to such a position, but Quakers are the only denomination as a whole come to this position. Of course, one of the reasons you can totally free yourself with slavery is the meetings have to be willing to say, okay, that's not your individual conscience, that's wrong, we're throwing you out. And for modern Friends, it's, what does somebody have to do to get themselves disowned? We allow much more leeway in things. And actually you'll see in the John Hunt Journal, when it comes out and everybody's got the 6 volumes on their shelf, that he's still traveling around in this fashion in the late 1780s. This is long after all the Quaker slave owning has been gotten rid of, but you still have these sort of weird cases like the husband who actually has title to the slaves is not a Quaker and his wife is. What do we do with this? Cases where somebody has received in a estate from rich ownership, a 1/3 ownership of some poor enslaved person. How do I free a third of a person? Doesn't that mean I'm objectively just relinquishing my rights to these two people that are, just all kinds of problems? And then the In a lot of cases, they're setting up meetings for African Americans. They're visiting, they're looking at schools. You know, probably they didn't do as much as they should have, but they certainly did a considerable amount. The same kind of thing with Native Americans. You know, there's sort of a feeling of obligation there. And one of the things I think is part of Quaker anti-slavery is, in fact, the idea that we know that our ancestors were engaged in these practices. And it took us a while to do it. And we did a wrong thing, and there's a victim here. And so the reason that we're interested in the welfare is not simply philanthropy. I see you and you need a sweater, and I give you a sweater because you're cold, but I see you and you're Lenape, and the reason our ancestors, or Quaker ancestors, survived in the howling wastes of southern New Jersey is local Lenape Indians sort of took them in and gave them a shoulder for the first year and taught them how to do this and that. So it's not just philanthropy, it's a debt owed. People now talk about reparations, but it's sort of the similar idea. You treated our ancestors better than most of us have treated your ancestors. And that means you are poor and we are rich. And if our money came from those sources, again, it's the tainted fruit from the tainted tree. I keep rattling on. Do people have questions in the middle of all this? Clarifications?
Was there any Quaker involvement in the ratification of the 14th Amendment abolishing slavery? Were there Congress people, senators, or anything?
I don't know specifically. What Quakers were fairly good at, well, for example, the Emancipation Proclamation is an easier one to do. There was a delegation of five or six people from the Progressive Friends at Longwood, and it went down to see Lincoln and urge emancipation because, you know, we all know the war is about slavery. The only way to, you know, get us sort of free of it is emancipation. And there were another group of very conservative friends that came down, including Joseph Britton, who also lived in Chester County. And they talked to Lincoln sort of in a more religious context. So this is a bad thing we do, and we have, you know, we don't really know his responsibility. We're all responsible for it in some fashion. And if you read Lincoln's second inaugural address, it's very interesting because here's the leader of a country that's just about to wipe the Confederacy off the face of history, and he's saying that, you know, we don't know how slavery came about. We don't know the only thing we don't know about it. Why? But we basically said to him, but we are all responsible for this. You know, us good Northerners, you know, can't get off by claiming our purity. And if God, you know, this is Lincoln, the President of the United States, if, you know, if God so wills it that the war will continue until every drop of blood drawn by the lash will be drawn by the sword, you know, we still will say he's a just and merciful God. So that sort of perspective. So you have these individual visits, and then you also have the Meeting for Sufferings, which becomes representative meeting, and they're constantly lobbying back and forth. I don't know the specific answer to your question, but it's fairly likely. Quakers are very good about lobbying behind the scenes. You can get a lot of things done if you don't care who gets credit for them. So there, you know, there are things like the Alternative Violence Project. You know, it was a Quaker project once upon a time, but the whole idea was to get it out there. And because you keep identifying as a Quaker project, oh, Quakers, they're crazy. They drive buggies and you know, oh, that's the Amish, I'm sorry. You know, Quakers, they're crazy. Of course they do things like that. Like women ministers. No women ministers until the 1970s. Well, what about these ones? Are these Quakers? Oh, it's Quakers. They're crazy. We don't worry about it. Slavery. You know, the whole kind of thing. So the idea is how do you move concerns like this over into the mainstream? And that sometimes you're a little quiet about it. The Pennsylvania Abolition Society formed in 1775, a week before the Battles of Concord in Lexington. So a week before the United States tried to become free by force of arms, people were getting together in Philadelphia and said we should free people nonviolently. And so who did they get for the president? Benjamin Franklin. So it's this whole gaggle of Quakers and Benjamin Franklin. And Benjamin Franklin gets credit for writing this anti-slavery tract. He's not writing it. It's a little committee of Quakers scribbling around in the back. And they're writing it. But this is right after the Revolution, and Quakers had a sort of reputation. Aren't they really Tories? You know, from the very least, they didn't help us. Benjamin Franklin owned slaves. And New York Manumission Society, same thing, founded a little later, 1787, I think. Either first or second president was Alexander Hamilton. And the other one was John Jay. Hamilton owned slaves. I think he may have freed them they may have not owned slaves by this time, but so what you did is you picked somebody who didn't at all look like a Quaker. And what better than this war hero from the American Revolution to be president? I mean, you don't want Elias Hicks walking in there with his, you know, plain clothes and muddy boots. I've talked long enough, except for one thing. One of the things that really intriguing about the journal of Joshua Evans is we have about six different manuscript copies of it. It floated around. People thought it was interesting, so they copied it, and they gave it to somebody, and they all those sort of things. So it's sort of this patchwork of none of them cover the entire period, but then we'll have three journals that all cover a certain period together, and they don't agree with each other about wording. You know, people were just more liberal with editing off, like, oh, you really mean it, said it that way. You know, that's awkward construction, so we'll do it back again. And Joshua Evans takes two extensive trips down to the South as far as the Carolinas in the late 1790s. And he is horrified with what he sees of plantation slavery, which is, again, you know, it's hard to make these kind of saying, oh, it wasn't as bad here, but Josh Evans knew quite well what slavery looked like in New Jersey. And that usually was, you know, one or two people, you know, working in a family. He was going down south and there would be everybody out in the field would be buck naked. You know, why buy them clothes? And on his way back, since we have no children in the room, he makes this kind of riff about what's going to happen when they become to us what we are to them now, or words to that effect. Not if slavery changes, but what happens when it changes. And they treat our women as, they use our women as we have used theirs. And because one of the things Josh Evans is noticing is like, why are all these mulatto kids around? That's something most abolitionists, a lot of abolitionist literature of the 19th century will allude to. You know, why are there so many mulattoes? So if you're interested in race mixing, like slavery seems to be a good place to race mixing. But Evans makes it very clear this is something that is really happening without consent of the women, and men just have to stand back and nothing here to see, nothing going on, and just a terrible situation. But I have never seen something that straight expressed in an 18th or 19th century journal. It's a thing everybody else is much too polite to say. You know, you talk about mulattoes, but you wouldn't draw the exact conclusion that the way you get mulattoes is you use African-American women. Anyway, this whole stuff is a lot of fun. We've been working on it for quite a number of years. The script is fairly easy to read once you know how, but it's worse to try to transcribe because he often doesn't spell the same thing in different ways. Lippincott, several spellings of Lippincott. Get some of Cadwallader, and you're all over the place, or little abbreviations. You know, they abbreviate things just by dropping out letters in the middle of a word. It makes perfect sense when you look at it, but it's like...
Thank you for listening to Clearly Quaker. We hope you have found this podcast thought-provoking. If you have questions or comments, or would like to learn more about South Jersey Quakers, reach us at salemquarter.net. Thank you.